RA Exchange. Welcome to Resident Advisors Exchange. I'm Chloe Lula, the Exchange's senior producer. How did reggae become the sound of resistance in the UK? In this RA Exchange, the influential Barbados-born reggae guitarist, bass player, and record producer Dennis Bevell talks about moving to South London at the age of 12 and navigating its tense racial and musical landscape. Through the music he wrote and produced, he responded directly to racist rhetoric and colonialist attitudes rocking the UK. After the arrival of the Empire Windrush ship in June 1948, which brought a generation of Caribbean people over to rebuild post-war Britain, the UK experienced new social pressures as the diaspora assimilated to their new lives. But London also became a melting pot of creative and cultural diversity, and reggae became resistance music, and artists like Bevell, bandleaders. Bevell speaks with Tony Nwakuchu about music as social commentary, especially in his reggae band Matumbi, which was intentionally provocative, aiming to challenge the status quo and give voice to the Black British experience through its lyrics, themes, and messaging. Matumbi was critical in developing the British reggae sound, and Bevell went on to record other musical projects that were key in shaping the early days of reggae, Jamaican Dub and Lover's Rock. He also reflects on his time spent engineering for artists in different scenes, like the German electronic duo Sada Bonaire, the Japanese band Yellow Magic Orchestra, and Ryuichi Sakamoto's solo work, as well as countless dub musicians and the singer Bobby Cray. Bevell's unique ability to bring together different musical styles at the peripheries of dub sensibility made him a highly sought-after collaborator, with a special ability to navigate delicate dynamics in the industry, especially for Black musicians and artists. Bevell is a great storyteller, and he shares some memories of recording with synthesizers that Rolling Stones once left in a recording studio, and he sings some of the synth lines that became sonic signatures in his own tracks. He also talks about his family, who actively dissuaded him from going into music. They were all scholars and academics, and when his parents told him that music wasn't a real occupation, he simply replied, "Try saying that to Ray Charles or Stevie Wonder or the Beatles." Across the next several decades, Bevell went on to make a lasting imprint of his own. Thanks so much for listening. Here is Dennis Bevell.
Welcome to our exchange. My name is Tony Nwakuchu, and I am joined today by the legend and the inspiration, Mr. Dennis Bevell.
Thank you for inviting me.
You're welcome, sir. How are you doing today?
I'm very well. I'm just wishing there was a bit more sun about.
Yes, indeed. Well, let's talk about your first time in the UK. So you came here at the age of 12, right?
Correct.
And so what was it like for you? You know, you grew up in Barbados, in the sun, in the warmth of the Caribbean. What was it like to kind of be drafted over here at the age of 12? What was your first impressions of being here?
Well, before I came, I didn't want to come because there were children my age who had gone before me and had reported that it was not the best place to be in terms of temperature. So my father had the idea to bring me here in the summer. So
smart,
when I
smart
came,
man.
It wasn't that bad. You know, it wasn't that bad. The only thing that I wasn't allowed to do was to go out barefooted. And that was the thing that I loved doing in Barbados, because I had to wear shoes every day for school and on Saturdays for church. And therefore, at any opportunity where I could take the shoes off my feet and run on the sand, it was appreciated, because we lived in a place where our back garden was the sea.
Okay.
And our back garden was sand and palm trees, coconut trees.
So you, by the temperature, you kind of were home for home.
Yeah.
By the temperature. I can believe it. So, so what was it like growing up? You know, you were here from 12. Obviously, you schooled here.
Mm-hmm.
You were into music at school as well. So, tell us what it was like growing up.
I fell in with younger musicians my age who had a little group going.
Mm-hmm.
And there were three English lads, and they were looking for a fourth person to join that group. In the same way that the Beatles were a four-piece band.
Mm-hmm.
And not until Jimi Hendrix came along did anyone realize that a three-piece band could smash it too, right? So I joined this three-piece, and it was a guitarist, a bass player, and a drummer. And I joined as a second guitar player, probably lead guitarist. And they liked the way I played. And so I was in, albeit the token black person, you know, and frowned upon by other black boys who were like, yeah, that group with those white boys and you're playing that pop music, you know. But I didn't mind because I stood out a bit and I enjoyed standing out a bit. Now, my grandfather taught music to quite a lot of people in our village in Barbados because he was, apart from being a carpenter, a joiner, a lay preacher, and music teacher. And all his children, my mom and her brothers and her sister, all read music. Albeit what they call sol fa, you know, do re mi fa sol la ti do. They could sing any song using that method, like do re mi fa sol la ti do, la, you know, and sing the notes, right? And granddad taught them that. He didn't teach me though, because by the time it came for me to learn that, I was heavily engrossed in learning the guitar, you know, and all I had to do to be taught the guitar by my mum's younger brother was to be able to sing the open tuning for him. That's the sound that the guitar makes with no hands on the frets, open string, and it's a tune, it's a melody. And I learned it at the age of 10. It goes dee doo dee doo doo doo. That's the six strings of a six string guitar. And I would have to sing the open tune, go, sing it. And I'd sing it, and I go, da, 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 da. I go, here, go, give me the guitar. And then he taught me, the first song was, oh, when the saints go marching in. Because we're coming from a religious family.
Yeah.
I was allowed to play any gospel, any piece of classical, but nothing by the Mighty Sparrow, or nothing by Lord Kitchener, or nothing by the Merry Men, you know, nothing secular, because my granddad referred to that as the devil's music.
I think that was quite a common phrase at that time. For
people. Yeah, and he would not have the devil's music in his house.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to do that, do it outside, not in here, right?
But as a true, you know, person with character and spirit, you kind of defied that in later years, right?
Well, rules were made to be broken. Exactly. I was determined to be a musician, even though my father, who had studied music under the hands of my grandfather and was a student of Trinity College here in the UK, he thought, no, you can't, don't go that way. Music, all the musicians I know have either been ripped off and they're broke or they've been shot because of that. You know, music is not an occupation.
Yeah.
You know, I said to him, look, you cannot say that to Sam Cooke. You cannot say that to Stevie Wonder or Ray Charles or Benny King, the Drifters and all that. And you cannot say that to the Rolling Stones or the Beatles or any of them that are making wads.
Yeah. There's always exceptions to the,
the rule.
Yeah, exactly. So, I guess after school, well, I guess during school, obviously you were in band, you played lots of different bands, but how did that those experiences then kind of come relate into the setting up of Mutumbi?
Well, first of all, the first band was called Roadworks Ahead. That fizzled out when two of the members left school early because in those days you could leave school at 14 or 15. Didn't really push to do anything more. We thought that the group had run its course.
Mm-hmm.
And there were older boys now who wanted me to be in their band. But before I joined their band, I thought, under the influence of a guy called Peter Hope,
mm-hmm.
he said to me, "Dennis, all this guitar band is an old hat. You have to have a keyboard player. You have to have some, where am I at 15 going to find a person who plays keyboard and owns the keyboard to gig with us?" And he said, "Nick Straker." I was like, "Okay." So I called Nick because we were in the same year at school.
Mm-hmm.
Said, "Nick,
you play piano?" "Yeah." I had the good fortune to be a kind of favorite of the head of music, who had entrusted the keys to the music room into my care.
That's a big deal.
So I could let myself in and out of the music room, and often did. I also had access to the school's recording studio, and I was frequently in there. So at lunchtime, I could be found in one of three places: the school studio, the school's music rooms, or in the chapel, where I had the privilege of playing the pipe organ. And Nicholas and I would often be in there, and the kids in the playground can hear the organ from the chapel, and we're struggling to be Keith Emerson. The two of us, it was a double manual organ, one on one side on the left and one on the other on the right side, and we were going, da 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 da
da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da da
da da da da da da da da da da da da da When I found out that he was such a formidable keyboard player, and he had his own organ. He had an organ called the Vox Continental.
Okay.
Where the white keys were black and the black keys were white.
Mm.
So it was, you know, an amazing thing to look at.
Mm.
You know, all the sharps, not traditionally on the keyboard black, well, they were white.
Mm.
And then all the whites, you know. And at that time, reggae began to feature the organ. So we had someone who could do that, you know, and then a chick on the guitar. So we were poised to become a reggae band. We decided, you know what, let's do a reggae band. And it was at the insistence of a friend of ours, right, by the name of George Pennant. Rest in peace. He said to me one day, he said, "Dennis, all this Hendrix fuzz box and all that, that's not you." He said, "There's only one Jimi Hendrix and it ain't you." Offended by that remark. I thought, "You're joking. Have you heard me play Hendrix with my fuzz box?" Going, the new trend is reggae. Think Toots and the Maytals. Think the Pioneers. Desmond Dekker, and the picture began to, and the money began to drop. Mate, that is the way forward. That is the beat that's going to storm the world. I want to be at the forefront of that.
Okay. Well, tell us what the first rehearsal was like.
So we had a rehearsal space in Clapham, in a place called Cato Road, off of Clapham High Street there. And we rehearsed there, and we rehearsed enough material to go into the recording studio on our own recognizance and record, because we knew recording was the way forward.
Yep.
Because we had been approached by a man by the name of Pat Kelly, who was a huge reggae singer back in the day. He was one of the only reggae singers that had obtained a chart position.
Okay.
Trojan Records was his record label, and he had a chart position with a song called "How Long." How long will it take me to be your man again? And he sang a bit like Curtis Mayfield. And he wanted Matumbi to be his backing band. And we accepted and started touring the UK with a man who was appearing in front of white audiences.
Mm-hmm.
We had been until then playing in the black circuit in the community, blah, blah. But this was going to catapult us to concerts around the UK attended by mainly English people. And we did that. And then after that, we did Johnny Clark.
Okay.
And then after Johnny Clark, we did Ken Booth.
I guess let's just give it, let's rewind a little bit. So obviously from setting up this band, finding some rehearsal space, getting a manager in, start building your own material up and developing that, suddenly you're then propelled to a different kind of setup, right? You've become from a band doing your own music and obviously developing your style to actually becoming working with international stars, right?
Yeah, well, the thing was that for people coming from Jamaica to request us to be their backing band,
it's a big
that
deal.
Was a big, big deal. You know, I think our heads were beginning to swell. So we'd backed so many Jamaican artists, and including the very famous Iroy. Now, we'd all been fans of Iroy from, you know, the sound system. But there he was coming to London, courtesy of Lloydie Coxon, so Coxon Sound, brought him, and then we were going to be the first band that backed not a singer, but a toaster.
Yeah.
And normally, Big Youth, Uroy, all those people came to London to perform on sound systems with DJs, right? With DJs on the B-side of their record.
Yeah.
Here was a guy coming, not to use the record, but to play with a live band who could then dub in and out. That's where we learned our dubbing skins, to stop, let the DJ talk, drum and bass, their rhythm coming in, orchestrated, you know, and that was very fun. In fact, he came for 3 months and stayed for 3 years.
And that was really unique at the time, right? Because, you were the go-to backing band. And to be the band that had the sound of authentic Jamaica was obviously a huge deal, right?
It was.
Yeah. So I want to play a track of yours just to for us to kind of get some sense of, what it was like for Mutumbi to be around. I'll play the track and you tell us something about it.
Song was written at the age of 16. It was one of our first compositions. The writing of that song coincided with a speech made by a certain Enoch Powell. There's going to be Rivers of Blood.
His famous Rivers of Blood speech, right?
Yeah. So we reacted by saying, sooner or later, the day's coming. Babylon shall be overthrown.
Nice.
Right? That means all that evil is going to be reversed. Right? But when we first approached Trojan Records with that song, they said, no.
Bit too hot to handle.
Too hot. We can't. we had been recording in a studio in Wimbledon by the name of R.G. Jones, which was reputed to be the top studio in London, at least, where people like Cliff Richard recorded. We were recording that song in Studio A, because by then we'd saved enough money, acquisition, Studio A,
Studio,
to record this stuff. While we were recording that, in Studio B was a group called Average White Band. We saw in the studio a Mellotron. Now, the Mellotron had been frowned upon by the musicians' union.
Because obviously it's replicating musicians and it's recording them in a way.
And it was supposed to be taking work away from string players and all that. But string players at the best of time were a bit snotty. So some people welcomed the invention of what was the first synthesizer.
Strawberry Fields and the Beatles, etc.
All of that.
Yeah.
We noticed that instrument in the corner of the Studio A and pleaded with the engineer to let us use it. And he said, no, we can't. That instrument belongs to Brian Jones from the Rolling Stones. Well, he won't mind. We knew of their rebelliousness. So we borrowed it because that instrument, the Mellotron, had been featured on the Hot Chocolate tune. Right, and we thought, let's do a reggae version of it. We got the instrument to do the parts with it, right? Mm-hmm. And we'll do it not to release, because we abhorred doing reggae versions of pop songs because that was the norm of the day. We didn't want to do that. We'd written our tune, Wipe Them Out, and other tunes like that, right? Hoping to be quite rebellious in the business, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But Trojan Records had another idea. They said, that cover version that you've done, we like that, you know. And to get on that label, you had to be not a reggae band experimenting with reggae in London, but come from Jamaica. Yeah,
absolutely.
Or you had to be the Cimarrons. So we didn't mind, because the Cimarrons were playing nice boy reggae. We were the rebels, right? We were playing Drive Them Out of Africa, you know, and they were going, you guys are popular in, you know, in the concert hall, but I don't know if you're going to be able to make the change to mainstream Radio One.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't really care. Whilst we were recording, Trojan said, all right, we're going to put you in the studio, you know, we're going to afford you a record. Because that one that you've given in to us, it was just a 4-track recording. We want to record you on 16-track. And we were like, yes, thank you. So they put us in the studio.
The same studio or another
one? No, another studio in Northwest London. In Willesden, in fact. The studio was called Morgan's. It is now called Factory or something.
Okay.
In Northwest London.
When did you start developing your skills as a studio engineer?
Well, when I was at school, before Matumbi,
mm-hmm.
our school
had a recording
had
studio.
A recording right? studio. Yeah. The recording studio was meant for the drama group,
mm-hmm.
which is, the school had a healthy drama group, it had a healthy orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was very, very poised for people who wanted to be in the arts,
mm-hmm.
you know. And so a lot of students at my school went to art college,
mm-hmm.
you know, and this studio that they'd built to make sound effects for the drama group, of which I was also a member of the drama group and secured the lead part in 2 school plays before I left, and had some of my sins forgiven by the headmaster. One of the sins that he had put at my door was the fact that when the studio was being built, there were plenty of black boys under the guise of learning to be carpenters, learning to be masons. But when it was being operated, there were no black kids in the operational part of the thing. So one day I took it upon myself to go there and say, look, there's got to be at least one of us involved in this because we built it,
mm.
right? and there should be one of us getting the knowledge of how it works.
Absolutely.
So that person is me. And in fact, I'm the representative of all the black kids in this school that built this facility. And so I think I should be chief engineer. Had I was given the knowledge of how tape recorders work.
From someone else there, or did you just learn on your own?
From the master in charge. Yeah, okay, cool. Right? And then I developed that, and then I developed my own way, because instead of making sound effects for the school play, I'd bring my friends in and do some recording.
Mm-hmm. So forwarding on with this expertise, you obviously got jobs as engineers in studios. Yeah. But then where did you make that transition from being an engineer to actually being a producer?
Well, that was, I think, when I had gone into the recording studio with Lloydie Coxon to record a song with a young girl by the name of Louisa Mark. And that song was called Caught You in a Lie. And Lloydie wanted to do a reggae version of this R&B song that he used to start up his sound system. Whenever his sound system was set, the first tune he would play would be Robert Parker, Caught You in a Lie.
Mm-hmm.
So he thought it was politic to do a reggae version of that because he was a reggae sound and have this young girl singing who was a brilliant young singer.
Mm-hmm.
And when he told me, I thought, yeah, because she had sang on my sound system a couple of weeks before that. And Dennis Brown was in the audience. And when I put her to sing on the B-side of his Silhouette. Now, when she started singing that tune, Dennis ran up to me and said, who that? I was like, hey, she have it in her. She's got it, man. And I went, yeah, you're right. So Lloydie had put her in a talent competition in the Four Aces Club to sing on his sound system, and she won. And she was very good. She was 14 at the time, and we'd gone into the studio and recorded this Caught You in a Lie. Now, I had reinstated our drummer to play this, right? He came off the bench and was in the starting lineup, right? And he did very well. We did very well. In fact, there was just him and I and the singer of Matumbi who's there. And I ended up being the multi-instrumentalist, albeit a bit of showing off. You know, I can play the bass, yeah, I can play the guitar, and I can play the keyboards, and I can engineer, and I can play the synthesizer, because the synthesizer had been, it'd been included in songs by Dandy Livingstone, who was the Gorgon, the general that had given us Susan, Beware of the Devil, and more importantly, a song called Big City. Big City, Bright Lights, Dandy Livingstone, right? That was reggae that was in the charts on the Trojan label and on TV. He also gave us the phenomenally song that was repeated in some later years by a group called The Specials. The song called A Message to You, Rudy, right?
The classic.
So in Dandy's repertoire, in that song, Big City, there was this thing in the background, the synthesizer went, meow, 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 an instrument that had been used by no less Rick Wakeman, right? And people like that, Deep Purple, Yes, you know, all these prog bands were using that instrument. And that instrument was also an instrument that was available for use in the recording studio where I worked. So when the beginning of Caught You in a Lie, the original, was a saxophone thing going, ba ba da ba 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 da ba ba da ba ba, very R&B, ba ba da ba 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 da. I thought, we can't have that. This is a new revolutionary reggae thing. So I took this keyboard and went, and Lloydie went, did you record that? I was going, yeah. He's going, don't rub it out.
And what synth was that?
That was the Moog synthesizer.
The model, the...
Oh, it's the first model, the one you had to plug in and tune.
Mm-hmm.
In the studio at that time was Robbie Shakespeare.
Okay.
And as a matter of showing off, I was like, hey, Robbie, I bet you ain't got one of these in Jamaica. Right? And then to add insult to the injury, the Moog was a monophonic synthesizer. You can only play one note at a time. So I double tracked it to have harmonies.
Okay.
Right? Two or three times playing chords on the Moog synthesizer. In fact, when I did that, Lloydie Coxon gave me the nickname of Doctor Who. And in fact, for many years, he always refers to me, Doctor Who.
That's right. Nice. That's... So tell us what it was like to actually think about building a studio. What equipment did you have to start off with?
Well, I was a studio called Ridge Farm in Capel in Surrey, near Horsham, and producing, not reggae, punk, with a group called The Pop Group. Mm-hmm. I did an album with them called Why. Mm-hmm. And straight after that, I did an album with a group called The Slits, both of whom were not reggae at all.
No. But I mean, we'll get to that. I mean, I've got a question about that in a second, but just, yeah, continue. Right.
So
yeah.
From there, some friends in London, one of whom had been credited as being an engineer on the Rolling Stones' first album, a man by the name of William Farley. We used to call him Bill Farley. He had been the proprietor and owner of a studio in Dalston above the snooker hall around the corner from Balls Pond Road,
mm-hmm.
where lots of budding reggae instrumentalists had come through. And Lloydie Coxon, to his credit again, said to me, Bill Farley wants to have a word with you. So I went to see Bill Farley, and he invited me to be involved in his studio runnings, which I thought, oh, it's too far from home. Shoreditch. So his next idea was, we come together and I'll get all the equipment you need and we'll build a studio and you confront it. So I thought, now that's a better idea.
Mm-hmm.
So another friend had said, I know where there's a building that we can use for at least 8 years because they're going to knock down all the buildings around there and that building is going to be the last one to be demolished.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll have 8 years to use that studio, lose that space. 4,000 square foot. It was a huge room. In fact, we had to build a room within the room,
yeah.
Mm-hmm. You know, and it was opposite where is now the site of the Globe Theatre,
okay.
In Southwark.
Mm-hmm.
So it was quite central and easy for me to commute to and to have my own studio. So I went for it, and my friend Don Letts had been to Japan with The Clash, mm-hmm. came back beaming, and Dennis, I've met Ryuichi Sakamoto. I'm like, well, good for you. I'm a fan of Ryuichi and wouldn't mind meeting him. So he said, oh, good, because he wants your telephone number. We'll give it to him.
Mm-hmm.
And Don was like, phew, thanks for that, because I already have given him your number. I'm going, what? But I was like honored for Sakamoto to be calling me, to be saying, I hear you're building a studio. I'm like, yeah, but it's not ready yet. And he said, I want to use it. And I'm like, yeah, you're welcome, man. You know, I'm a Yellow Magic Orchestra fan, you know, and to be approached by the Don to work on his first solo album outside of Yellow Magic Orchestra was a deep honor. So I said, yeah, but Ru, you'll have to wait till I get it, you know, up and running. He went, you don't understand. I want to use your studio before you. Oh,
that's a big deal.
That's a big deal. So I had to hurry up the finishing of the studio.
Yeah.
And in fact, Bill got me all the equipment, except that I needed 24 Dolbies as my noise reduction.
Yeah, got you.
So he had a friend, Sir George Martin, Air Studios. He went to George Martin and said, we need to borrow some Dolbies from you. And he went, you mean rent them? He said, yeah, we want to borrow them for a fee. So I then brought in 24 Dolbies from Air Studios to put in my studio. And Sakamoto arrived and we did a couple of tracks for his...
Of which?
His first solo album, B2 Unit.
Let's listen to one of those.
Okay, and it's called Riot in Lagos, right? Big tune.
Classic,
mate. A lot of people didn't know that I was involved with that, and when they found out, it was like, is that you? And I'm, yeah, it was recorded and mixed from scratch to finish in my studio with Ryuichi Sakamoto alongside.
It's amazing. So can you, what was it like, what would talk us through the kind of compositional process of that track?
Well, first of all, he had a keyboard that I'd never seen before, and it was a Prophet 10. And not what we were used to. We were used to the Prophet 5, which was a single manual thing. He had a Prophet 10, which was a double manual thing. And he began by playing the kick drum. And then...
Was it sequenced or played manually?
He played it manually. Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then he said, okay, now I'm going to do the snare. And each time he would layer and layer and layer until he had a drum track. Then he started to play the bass pattern in very much the same way as I did when I was recording myself. Drums first, you know, bass next, keyboard. And he was following the same pattern because he knew that was how I did it. And that was, he knew that was how he wanted it done. And then once he piled all the instruments on, he said to me, I've done what I want to do. Now you do your way.
Gotcha.
And then I started mixing it and dubbing it, and he was going, yeah, that's exactly where I imagined it, yeah, yeah. And, you know, we got along famously.
Incredible. It's an incredible record. It's definitely
I agree.
In my top five, personally. So.
All right, thank you very much. Yeah. In fact, it was just a re-release before his death recently. And I found out that that was actually the first instrumental dub electronic album coming out of Japan.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. I mean, yeah, you know, there's, it's, I can't say much more about it. It's incredible, incredible.
And there
record.
He was saying, right, yeah. In Lagos. He was,
yeah,
he was,
absolutely. Well, that, as a child, that's what, well, apart from the title for me was obviously a Nigerian kid growing up in London.
Yeah.
And this electronic track for me, that was freaked me out.
Yeah.
You know, and obviously listening to the track again, freaked me out. Yeah. So Yeah, it's been a staple since, yeah. To get back to this whole idea of you, people knowing you for reggae, but then as a producer, you know, the times were quite interesting. Reggae became obviously a fashionable sound.
Yeah.
And I guess you became the go-to person to...
to get that sound.
Get that sound, particularly for bands that weren't necessarily from the reggae genre.
Yeah.
Hence the work with the Slits yeah. and the pop group. And obviously a lot of bands at that time, as well as doing new wave or doing reggae, were also having some kind of reggae sound. Track. Yeah, and then you were that guy.
Yeah, because I knew, in fact... the beginning of me working with Linton Kwesi Johnson, he came to interview me in a Matumbi gig, and he said to me during our conversation, he said, my friend Vivian Weathers tells me that if I want to capture the reggae sound in London, you're the go-to. I was like, oh, thank you, Vivian. And so, because I had become synonymous with actually getting the that deep bass end and the kick end and the thin hi-hat and getting the sound of reggae, which was afforded me by playing a sound system and knowing what frequencies recorded well and played back well and actually putting them on the tape, you know. And so that's how we began our relationship, with me actually being the person that can get the kind of the reggae sound that could easily be mistaken for being recorded in Jamaica.
And how obviously you're someone who's very adaptable, very amenable. I can see that from where you are. And I guess if you're working with, you can work with anyone, right?
I think so.
Yeah. But then how did you, what was it like working in the studio with, you know, people who were from, a, I guess, different cultural background, different musical ideas?
It was eye-opening. Because I then went to Germany to work with a group that the doing something revolutionary. They were called Sada Bonheur. And it was two German girls who were employing the services of the Turkish National Orchestra and me in Bremen, in West Germany, to create a disco kind of Arabic feel record. And I thought, this is a great opportunity. So when my friend Ralph von Richter called me up and said, look, this is an opportunity, let's do something groundbreaking. I was there in a shot. And, you know, we did this record that has just been re-released. And these two young girls were not interested in singing. They were poets. They were reciting, like in a kind of way, like Amanda Lear. You know, they were reciting in a fashion that later became Grace Jones's thing. You know, and it appealed to me. There's been something completely different, forging the word with music, and it's a similar thing to what I was doing with Linton.
Yeah.
But in a different beat and a different country and a different style. And I, you know, I warmed that, and I welcomed working with people from around the world that gave me insight into what it is that they wanted, then I could, at will, include whatever it was I did with them in whatever it was I was doing for myself.
Absolutely. I guess you're just a, you know, an artistic sponge,
yeah,
right?
Soaking it up.
Yeah. Got one more track to play. Well, a couple more tracks to play. I'll just play this and you tell us about it.
Maria
You found that one.
I did indeed.
Man. Yes. Thompson Twins. I began to record the Thompson Twins. And we kind of ran out of a bit of time that I was had allotted to them. And the next project that was coming in through the door was Bob Fish, the singer of the Darts. And so I said to the Twins, I said, hey, can we delay what we're doing and get back to you in a couple of weeks or something? And they were not happy about that. But I put them on the bench anyway and went on to do the Bob Fish album. Now, the Thompson Twins were a seven-piece band at that time. And I was in charge of their first album, which was called Product Of. And I noted that Tom Bailey was tremendously talented, and that I thought he could possibly go it alone. And he heard me, I think.
Eventually.
And the band became a three-piece.
Yeah, so I wanted to really get across that, you kind of straddled these worlds of obviously reggae, you particularly British reggae. Mm-hmm. You were the kind of go-to producer, particularly in kind of for remixes in commercial pop music, mm-hmm. but also a lot of remixes. So you had a really eclectic clientele, I guess, yeah. Particularly in
Jarvis Cocker.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah, it's incredible.
And
it's incredible.
The smile. Mm. In fact, Johnny Greenwood, he contacted me and said, Radiohead's no more again. You lie. No more Radiohead. Are you kidding? I said, nah, man, we've drafted in a new drummer, whose name's Johnny as well, by the way. No, whose name's Tom Skinner. And Tom York and I have got this new drummer, and you've worked with him, and we've discussed, we've just recorded our first record as ex-Radiohead, and now The Smile, we're called The Smile. And this tune is called The Smoke. We want you to mix it. And before I could say yes or no, he sent me the files. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I thought, how do you say no to Johnny? You don't, right? Send it over. And then after a to-in and fro-in of what about this, what about that, what about this, the final mix I sent over, the response came, we think it's glorious. And then I thought, down tools, they think it's glorious.
Job done.
Job done.
Yeah.
And that record has catapulted me to the remix man to go to, I suppose, after all this time.
Yeah, so ebbs and flows, man. Yeah. Ebbs and flows. I mean, your sound is like, has been synonymous in the last 30, 40 years, right? Which is great in a kind of creatively covert kind of way, which is a beautiful thing. I just wanted to conclude on a couple of things. So first of all, looking back, you obviously contributed heavily to the creation and prevalence of Lover's Rock, right?
Yes.
What was it like? How did it emerge? You know, and how was it taken? I know it was definitely something that was very British, of course. Mm-hmm. So what made Lovers, what was different from you? What's different between, say, traditional sounding Jamaican reggae and Lovers Rock? Well, and then from there on, yeah, what was it like to see it emerge at that time?
It was wonderful to see it emerge. Lovers Rock, I had been of the idea that we needed equivalent of Diana Ross and the Supremes in reggae. We needed an equivalent of Aretha Franklin. We needed an equivalent of Gladys Knight. We needed groups that sang Lovers in reggae. Although there were some people in Jamaica doing it. I mean, you can't omit Dennis Brown and Gregory Isaacs and John Holt and Delroy Wilson and Johnny Clark and people like that. But what they were doing was not called Lovers Rock. It was only called Lovers Rock when we started to do it in the UK and wanted to find a name for the genre. Now, the word lovers and the word rock were given to us by a man called Lenny Chin, who was the boss of a record label called Santic. And on the Santic record label, there was a man by the name of Augustus Pablo, who everybody loved, who played the melodica. In fact, there's the Germans call it the melodica, and the Japanese call it the pianica, the same instrument. It's the old argument about who invented the cassette, you know, Germany or Japan. And anyway, the label Santic had issued a tune in the 70s, and the title of that tune was Lovers Rock. Now, those two words rang together in a kind of loving way. And to have the word rock to be added to lovers smacked of canoodling, you know. In fact, dancing cheek to cheek.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So this was a way that my generation could get hands-on. You know, instead of dancing apart,
mm-hmm.
with this type of music, you had the hands on.
Slow time.
And rub each other, yeah. You know, in a sexual way. And there'd be nothing in it, just to dance. To front this movement, I had long wanted female vocalists to front reggae, because reggae was heavily male. And being a brother of six sisters, I wanted to include my sisters in the making of singing reggae. And by that time, by the proof of the pudding being Louisa Mark, being successful at a young girl singing reggae, I then reached out for Marie Pierre, you know, 15, 16, 17, Brown Sugar, and the anthem turned out to be, after all this time, Silly Games with Janet Kay.
How did you get to meet Janet?
Well, I worked on a production of a man called Delroy Witter, who was the boss of a sound system. See, it all goes back to the sound system. A sound system called Success. Later on, he said, oh, I'm working with Sly Dunbar and Lloyd Parks, because they were in town to rehearse their group, Skin, Flesh and Bone, to be the backing band of Dennis Brown, who was about to embark on a tour to represent his hit, Money in the Pocket, whom I had been instrumental in allowing him to get on top of the pops with that song, because in those days you had to be a member of the Musicians Union or put forward by a member of the Musicians Union. I did that for Dennis Brown. He was my friend, and he was in through the door as my guest, as a union man.
Mm-hmm.
And so if anybody would care to see the video of Money in the Pocket, that's me on the organ, right? So they had made this record, Sly Dunbar and Lloyd Parks, and it was a version of Denise Williams' That's What Friends Are For.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but after all, that's what friends are for. And Janet had the perfect voice for that. But when I was called in the studio to do the mix, she wasn't around. Janet, I had been the musical director of I Do Love You. And that was the first time we were going to meet face to face. She knew that I'd worked on the tune before, but and she didn't know me as much as a musician, but she thought I was like, well, the sound engineer. But when it came to the backing vocals and I had to pipe in make sure that she was singing the right notes and that, you know. It was then revealed that I knew a thing or two about music. And then after the session, she said to me, here's my number. If you got anything you can involve me in session work, blah, 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 give me a call. And I thought, I've got a tune that fits your voice admirably, but you don't know it yet. So by the time I'd recorded the tune with Drummy Zeb and myself, I was in the control room. He was in the drum booth. I couldn't talk on the talkback whilst playing the bass and engineering. So I had to teach him the song by way of bass line.
Got you.
I was like, well, when the bass line is playing, do, 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 that's the verse. And when it's playing, doom, do, 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 it's got happy, doom, doom, that's the chorus. That's when she's singing. And he understood that admirably. So the two of us constructed the track, the drums and the bass. Then I took my time to put on the keyboards and to add my synthesizer signature. Dip, 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 dip,
dip, dip, dip, dip, dip, dip, dip, dip, dip, dip. The classic melody.
Yeah. And then I said, Janet Gay, listen to this song. And when I went, you can do that. I must be able to do that. Pass me the microphone. And the rest is our story.
I hear she, that note still got, still.
Well, she once said to me, I dislike you. I was like, why? She said, do you know what it's like to have to do a whole show? And I can't sing that tune in the beginning. I've got to sing that tune at the end of the show when my voice is fatigued from singing all night. Then I've got to go, I wish I never met you.
But equally, it's a beautiful to see the crowd when that track's played.
When I thought of that, it was because I was reminiscing of Ella Fitzgerald, who in an advert for Memorex, who were claiming to be reproductors of the authentic original sound. And Ella Fitzgerald's on stage and she sings a god-awful high note and then a glass breaks on the table nearby. Bing! When she sings. Wouldn't it be great if I could incorporate something like that in a song? And I managed to do it. And it took off.
It absolutely took off. The rest is history. It put Red Lovers on the map. It put British reggae on the map.
The other thing that I have to tell you is that the drum pattern, I had constructed it mentally, and it consisted of a hi-hat pattern that was reminiscent of soca or high life. The snare pattern was reminiscent of Afrobeat.
Because snare's on the off, right?
On the off. Yeah. And then the kick drum is disco. Four to the bar.
Boom, so boom, tip, boom. Yeah, it's great.
And so when I told Drummy Zeb, listen, this is what I want you to play, he was like, whoa, I wish I'd invented that. And then he got on it and played it as though he had. And when he, at one point on the second take of the song, when it went to play your silly, he was like, I thought, who's that in there, Phil Collins or Bill Bruford? I'm like, mate, I didn't want all that racket in the tune.
But it works, right?
Absolutely. On the second listen, I thought, you know what? That makes the tune. That makes the tune go into all those genres and then into a rock thing and then back to the original beat that I'd originally thought would be the new beat of reggae and it would dethrone Sly Dunbar from being reggae's top drummer.
On that note, let's leave it on a high with Silly Games. Dennis, thank you so much for your time,
thank
man.
You,
it's been awesome.
Young one.
Yeah, thank you.
Just the top of the counter.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the RA Exchange with Dennis Bavel. The track playing in the outro is his edit of Swanky Modes by Jarvis Cocker. You can watch this episode in full on our YouTube, and you can check out snippets on our social channels. If you liked what you heard today, please subscribe to the RA Exchange wherever you listen to podcasts. You can also dig back into the archives on RA.co or on the RA Exchange's SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or Spotify. As I continue to plan the rest of 2025, I'm looking for input from our audience, you, about the topics you'd like to hear covered on the Exchange. Are there any questions you want answered? Are there issues you think should be debated over by artists or critics? Send us an email at exchange@ra.co. I'll see you next week.